this chap, was it James Miller?
Yes.
And Henry Swansea, a product of that particular moment in British history where you have public school educated men who then go to Oxbridge or into the army officer corps. They were trained for the World War, they came out of the World War, and there was a certain imperial military mindset that was then, you know, all, shot all the way through the BBC, all the way through cultural institutions as well.
So, as I said, I'd like to talk to you about your own writing and your involvement in the work of the Singing Net and other literary programmes. Do you feel that Singing Net was an important part of the schedule for Radio Gaga?
Well, it was the only program that's encourage people to write fiction. There was also Ghana Theatre. Again, I contributed to that. Ghana Theatre was a half hour radio play. And again, that was conceived by Henry Swansea. We had a fight there too.
Coming from the newsroom as you did, and obviously there would be a priority with a new opportunity to tell news, to report news stories. Did you feel that really over, in terms of the programming and the scheduling, was there a position for literature, or was it just because it was Henry Swansea's, baby that it really found a position in the schedule?
There was a strict line of division between the news and programs.
Yeah.
News was all, they were all Scots, for God's sake. Why? Miller Scott, Swansea Scott, and the news head of news was Ian Wilson. But Ian Wilson and Henry Swansea didn't get on.
Why was that?
I don't know.
Just a personal dispute.
On the day that I published that article about Henry Swansea, Ian Wilson came to me and asked me, "You haven't been writing about Henry Swansea, have you?" Because I used a pseudonym. I said, "Yes, I have."
So what motivated you to write the article? You said it was on the last, you interviewed him on his last evening before he left. What?
I thought he had contributed tremendously to Ghana fiction, and also he did readings. I think he did readings from novels, and he was very good at it, different voices.
Yeah.
And I said that if you had him in the studio, you would think there were about six people in there. And after his program had finished and you saw him come out, it was only he. So I complimented him on that. I thought he was all around a very, very good artistic influence on Radio Ghana. And
you wanted to reflect on that time when he'd been there?
I wanted to pay him a compliment. Yeah. As simple as that. Yeah.
Interesting that you say to pay him a compliment. You'd mentioned earlier about having a bit of a love-hate relationship with him.
Well, I am me. I can divorce myself from my personal annoyances, if you like. Yeah. I'll see the big picture. He was a guy who was doing very good work for the country.
One of the things you'd said, good work in terms of his editing, and when we'd spoken previously, you'd mentioned him changing the end of Tough Guy in Town.
Yes.
I'd like to hear more about that.
Oh, having been a magazine editor, I don't now place too much. But I could see as he took an ideological view that he could not allow Tough Guy, having done what he did in that nightclub, basically beat people up, to go scot-free.
Sure.
And that for society's sake, he ought to be punished. Well, that was his ideological view. My ideological view was that he should walk off. So we came to a disagreement, and he didn't tell me he was going to do that, because I might have told him what I thought. He edited it. It was read by somebody else on the radio, and I had a fait accompli on my hands. It didn't please me too much. In that article in the New African, I speculated that he probably thought it wouldn't be a good thing to encourage people on the radio to go beating people up and walking scot-free, and that there was a price to pay. That was his idea. That wasn't mine.
It's interesting, isn't it, that moral line, again, is still an effort to kind of mediate literature, but also a kind of ideological, political...
Yes,
as well.
Yeah.
Who has the right to decide justice in any one situation?
To what extent do you think that, not just in your work, but you were obviously around and you were, you know, meeting and talking to other writers, but to what extent do you think that he was shaping and changing the type of literature that was then broadcast on air? You've given a personal example.
Well, that's about all I can say, really, yeah. Because I don't know what happened to other people's work, which passed through his hands. And it may be that he felt he could bully me because I was so young. 1957, 58.
Yeah. And do you think that, did he seem to be taking the BBC line, or was it a much more personal sense of what was morally right or what was quality in terms of literature?
There wasn't the BBC line. As I said, Ian Wilson and Henry Swazi didn't get on. Miller was on to his own sort of thing, doing his own thing. Basically, we in the newsroom realized that we must balance political coverage, so on, although we thought that they were on the side of the government more than on the side of the opposition. We were very, very sensitive to how the government reacted to the news. And I was in the forefront of political reporting. So I could see that they were very, very keen not to offend.
That's an interesting idea, being keen not to offend.
Oh, yeah. I mean, they wouldn't cut anything I had written. Try to be very accurate and balanced. But you could see that telephone calls after news bulletins, they would never come and tell you anything. You could sense it. When important political news was breaking, you could sense a bit of unease.
You mentioned before about the idea of the extent to which the, not just Swansea, but those that had come from the BBC, the extent to which they were or were not capable of seeing their new Ghanaian colleagues as, you know, mature people with a, you know, cultivated sense of where their work was going, that you weren't sure that that was always the way that that relationship worked.
I don't think I'd be as careless as saying that, because I didn't know. I simply didn't know how he related to them. Me and him, yes, I know exactly what was.
Sure.
But I can't generalize, broaden it to that extent. But I suppose it's only logical to think that if he was so didactic towards me, he might also be didactic towards others.
Yeah. Thinking about for us, the anthology, the Voices of Ghana anthology, is what we have as, you know, really the main record of what literature contributions there were to Radio Ghana. And I thought it was interesting to see that it's divided into town and countryside. There's also divisions in terms of, although they're almost entirely in English, the group from which the person belongs, so whether they were Ewe or Ga or Hausa, although they're writing largely in English. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about your sense of how, you know, issues of regionalism and nationalism seem to appear in your writing or other people's writing, and whether you think that Radio Ghana, you know, did a good job of kind of negotiating that move from one identity to another.
That was one of the major achievements of the radio at the time. That we had about 6 national languages in which we broadcast. And they were all giving their heads. Now, the creative staff came in fortuitously. If 10 of us wrote in a month, they would be considered. You wouldn't think, why am I only producing ever story? So I don't think that really mattered. But if he had an Ev in his hands, then he could say, okay, ever South, North, this and that. But as it happened, it wasn't like that at all.
And as a writer, did you feel like you were trying to kind of discover a Ghanaian national kind of literary voice, or was it still very personal for you? Was it an opportunity to offer something outside of Ghana?
I wrote basically out of vanity. I wanted my name heard and to entertain, you know, and become humorous and thereby be appreciated.
Yeah.
That's all I did. I mean,
I think that comes across in The Gab Boys very well. I mean, it's a very funny novel, as well as being tragic and kind of moving. But that humour and, you know, that desire to entertain, as I read it, is absolutely locked together with this idea of coming to political awareness, which the protagonist largely... it manifests itself through his girlfriend, the figure of B, doesn't it? She's the politicised.
Yes.
You know, not unproblematically because of the English sort of influence on her education.
Yes.
But that entertainment, that kind of the lightness of touch and part of the novel is still grounded by a kind of class consciousness and a consciousness about the history of colonialism. So, you know, those things I think can go very, very closely together.
Well, I'm very glad you noticed that because, of course, I had a point of view to convey. But the skill that I was trying to develop was to entertain, carry you along, and at the same time have my say about the political situation. And, that is also from my background. We really told each other funny stuff. Most of the stuff in the Gab Boys in elevated from sitting around with boys and telling each other nice stories. I was always a storyteller to begin with.
Yeah. First and foremost, whether factual or allowing fiction to reflect something that you felt more factually. Yeah.
Because, of course, first of all, you must be read. If you are not read, then what's the point of having a point of view? Yes.
You say that English language gave Amos Tutuola a world audience.
Thank you.
Do you feel the same about your own and for Ghanaian writers, that the English language in that sense enabled your writing?
Yes, but with an alas. Because no matter how...
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Good I am at writing or speaking English, there are times when I wish I was writing in Chi.
Yeah.
You know, you say 3 words and they resonate with a Chi speaking person, and you need a sentence or two to explain that to a person who doesn't speak Chi. So I miss that. I miss that a lot. But if you only wrote in Chi, you lose 3/4 of the country.
I think
So it's a compromise that we all have to live with.
A question that I've been grappling with as we've been working on this project that I'd just be interested in your viewpoint on. In a world influence on of literature, I found that Nigerian writers seem to have had a greater impact than Ghanaian writers. Why do you think that is?
Basically, they have a bigger market. A very, very big market. You know, Tutuola was selling about 20,000 in those days. You know, and British and American publishers needed, you know, if you have a print run of 40,000 and you know you can get rid of half of it like that, you will go with it.
So once there was a sense that there was a market for Nigerian writing, then other writers could continue to go with that momentum.
And they had some very good writers as well.
Yeah.
So there was a very happy confluence of sorts. Good market, good storytellers, and you are gone, yes. I mean, Ayikwe Ama, you know, with the kind of work he's done, should be as,
yes,
you know,
yeah,
as economically.
A name that's as well known, absolutely.
But he's not.
You mentioned Ama. Who would you say, without limiting ourselves to the, you know, the 1950s period that we've perhaps focused on, who do you believe has been the most successful Ghanaian writer and why?
Ama?
Yeah.
No doubt at all. He has no rivals.
Because of the beautiful ones, or
no.
Because of
the whole lot.
Yeah.
Beautiful ones. It's all right, very good and very simple. But some of the other stuff. Have you read it?
Yes.
Fully?
Well, no. I can't claim to have read everything.
I wonder, sort of taking on this line of the relationship between Ghanaian writers and publishing houses, what were your experiences of working with Andre Deutsch, who published the Gab Press? Were they a supportive publisher? Who did you deal with?
I dealt with a very good editor. I was very lucky. Dan Arthur.
And she was generous in her editorship. She kind of devoted.
She hardly touched anything.
That's interesting. Because, of course, she shared a flat with Henry Swansea during the war in London.
No!
They were flatmates. Yeah. In the beginning of her autobiography, she talks of remembering hearing Henry Swansea playing on the piano.
Okay.
You know, it was a divided house, so they were a top flat and a bottom flat, I think. They knew each other quite well, and I wondered whether Swansea had been...
This wasn't at Primrose Hill.
I think Devonshire Place. I think maybe, but I'll have to check. I wondered, did Swansea put you in touch with Andre Deutsch, or did you come across that through a different channel?
Completely different. When Conor Cruz O'Brien was Vice Chancellor of the University of Ghana, we were very great friends. And his agent was Lady Elaine Green, who was the wife of the Director General of the BBC at the time. So he asked me to send the novel to her. And I sent it to her, and she sent it to Deutsch, and it went through first. The first person that saw it took it. So that was it.
But it's interesting, isn't it, how these mechanisms work on a semi-formal basis. You know, the British class system, if you know somebody who knows the wife of the Director General of the BBC, who can put you in touch, there's a sort of informality.
You mentioned, I think, over email that when you'd arrived in 1965, it was Swansea who'd introduced you to some people at Bush House.
And, yes.
I'm interested in that time and that experience for you as coming as a young writer. Did you see yourself as a journalist more at that time?
Well, I've always been both. So I just put on a different hat when it's necessary. But Swansea came to work at Bush House when he came back. And of course, I called him and he introduced me to Veronica Manukia, who was a fantastic editor in the English fiction department at BBC Bush House. So I sent her a lot of the poetry that Swansea said wasn't poetry. And she was then working with Edward Blishing. Edward Blishing was the main presenter of the BBC African Fiction Outfit. But that introduction was all. And then I also wrote some plays for the BBC. And I was very comfortable with them.
So who else were you able to meet at that time? Did London give you an opportunity to network, not just with producers, you know, London-based producers, but other writers maybe from other parts of the world? I mean, we mentioned about the Caribbean writers that that Swansea had worked with before he'd come to Ghana, but I'm wondering what that literary circle felt like at the time and who may have been a part of that.
I didn't have a literary circle when I came to London. I was basically running away from Ghana because as editor of Drum, biggest magazine in Ghana, I had annoyed the authorities. And so when I came to England, I was intent on just surviving and writing. I wasn't interested in. I was very melancholy because I had been very, very optimistic about Ghana at independence. And the way things were going was not good for me. And I was therefore very, very uninterested in social networking or anything of the sort. And I didn't stay long enough. I came to England in September 65, I think it was. And by February 66, Nkrumah was overthrown.
Yeah.
So I went straight back.
That was your cue to go home.
Mm. Yeah.
So, driven by political changes whilst continuing to, as you say, be both, continue to write. And did you feel that the writing that you did personally responded to those rapid changes? Did you, as a writer, did you sense that you were responding to it?
Oh, yes. But I didn't write political stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, my novel writing was truncated because I could see that I earned about, at most, £1,000 from the Gap Boys. And the amount of work that I put into that, you know, compared to writing an article for The Observer or The Sunday Times or whatever, I just couldn't afford to become artistic in that sense. Well, at least I made a conscious decision that I had a family to look after, and I was going to do that. Writing would come when it would come.
So that need for there to be a financial focus kept your focus on that journalism.
That's really interesting, because to compare with the earlier pre-Second World War era in London, one of Swansea's great achievements, as acknowledged by Caribbean writers like George Lamming and Sam Selvin, even V.S. Naipaul, was that he understood that, and that's why all the work as readers on Caribbean Voices sort of contribution. He was determined to try and offer some material support to allow these individuals to become writers. And it seems that obviously, you know, in the 1960s, there wasn't a similar kind of mechanism available to yourself and perhaps others, which is a shame.
You've talked about the fact that at different times there was, political repercussions in terms of your news writing, in terms of journalism, and that's obviously understandable. Mm. Do you feel that literature was taken perhaps seriously enough to have political repercussions? Were there not necessarily your own, but were things that people that were writing at the time, was there a sense that the voice that was coming out through literature was...
There wasn't much literature coming out, period.
Yeah.
There just wasn't.
So it didn't have that opportunity in any way to...
I don't know whether it's opportunity, it's just that people were not writing properly. I mean, half of the stuff in Voices of Ghana can be dismissed. It's almost anthropological.
That's been really, really interesting. We've got a lot to think through.
We do.
Thank you very much.
Always come back if you feel this.
Hope to see you in Ghana when you come out. It would be lovely to chat through a few more things with you as well. Thank you. Yeah.